Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report, the second weekend show of 2026. You have Corey and Shad here as your hosts, and already a lot for us to talk about in 2026. A lot of geopolitics and a lot of still very positive moves in markets as well as commodities. Let's get into this show as quickly as possible. We are chatting with our good friend Peter Buchvar. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer at One Point BFG Wealth Partners and editor of the Book Report on Substack. I'll post a link to Peter's Substack in the show notes on our website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Peter, let's talk about the geopolitics that has dominated headlines this week, and that is the U.S. invasion of Venezuela. A lot of focus being on the oil markets. What is going to be the impact on the oil price? I know that you have been all last year fairly bullish on the oil markets and saying that there is opportunity here for investors. Quite frankly, Peter, does any of your outlook change after this news out of Venezuela?
It does not for the next couple of years. As we know, oil is a highly cyclical commodity, just as all commodities are, and they go through cycles. And I feel like with the price of WTI at $58 as we speak, we're clearly on the down cycle. 20 years ago, WTI was $60. You inflation adjust 60, 20 years ago to today, and oil would be 100. So I think that oil, in nominal terms, is a really cheap commodity. And the times to buy commodities is when they're out of favor and they're depressed. So to your question, yeah, there could be eventual increases in supply in Venezuelan oil, but it could be 7, 8, 10 years just to get back to where they were in terms of production prior to Hugo Chavez coming into power in 1999. And 3 million barrels a day in 7 to 10 years, considering today, let alone where we'll be in 7 to 10 years, that we're producing 105 million barrels a day, I don't think it's that relevant in the short term. I still think that, you know, and when you see extreme bearishness and low prices, you always try to look for what fundamental factors can tilt the positioning in the other direction. And of course, what would be the catalyst for people to care? And, you know, my list of reasons for a rally in oil just continue to grow. You know, on a sentiment standpoint, we know everyone's bearish. On a positioning standpoint, in the CFTC data that came out Friday in the US for the week ending last Tuesday, net speculative long positions are bouncing around the lowest levels in 15 years. You have what I believe is somewhat being ignored, and that's the oil production coming out of US shale, which seems to be maturing rather quickly. Yes, we did see another increase in oil production in the US in 2025 to record highs, about 13.8 million barrels a day. But you know, every report that I read is that a lot of the shale basins are rolling over in terms of production growth. Even the Permian is showing signs of that. And US shale production was the major swing factor over the last 15 years when US shale went from 5 million barrels to almost 14. OPEC, we know that they've been raising quotas, taking back the production cuts over the last 5 years post-COVID, but actual production increases are not matching up with the quota increases, which tells me that there are some issues with bringing production online, and maybe the quotas are just matching up with what was already being produced. And it seems that Saudi and UAE are the only countries with spare capacity. I don't think that the Saudis, well, we've seen over this past weekend, OPEC announced that they're maintaining their production quotas and not raising them again in Q1. I don't think the Saudis want lower oil prices from here. They've tolerated oil price decline up to this point, but I don't think that they're gonna be happy with anything declining further from here. And getting back to US shale, you know, about half of US shale starts to lose money below $50. So from a risk reward standpoint, I don't think that there's much downside. Also on the demand side, it's still growing more north of a million barrels a day. Even the IEA, which was always bearish on oil and believing that we're going to see peak demand like any day now. They pushed out their peak demand estimates to 2050. EV growth is not taking off like people hoped. So the use of oil in the both hybrids and internal combustion engine are going to continue on for years to come. We've seen a lot of major oil companies that have been more focused on cash flows and paying dividends and buying back stock and less in developing new finds. Now, we are getting more supply to Brazil and Guyana. So I'm not a believer that we're running out of oil. We're always going to find it. I just think that we're reaching a moment where we could get a cyclical rise in oil. Then you throw in the geopolitics. And yeah, we talk about Venezuela, but look what's going on in Iran. Any disruptions out of Iran could be noteworthy with them producing right now about 3 million barrels a day. You have the U.S. getting back to the U.S. U.S. oil rig count, the lowest level since September 2021. For all the talk about the oil supply glut, I look at the oil futures contract table out a year and a half, and it's kind of flattish. So not telling me that there's all this supply out there. Yes, a lot of it could be on the water because it's not in Cushing. You look at Cushing inventory levels, they're pretty low. And from a cheapness perspective, the gold to oil ratio is off the charts. So now I can't tell you when oil is going to rally, but I'm lining all these things up and telling me that from a risk reward standpoint and oil stocks in the less than 3% of the S&P 500, I don't know. It seems pretty compelling. You put this all together. And I know I'm sort of swimming upstream here. I know I'm an outlier in terms of being bullish on oil prices, but that actually makes me kind of comfortable being so.
Well, Peter, it's been an interesting last year when you look at the contrast of oil as a key commodity, a key inflation input, something that, you know, we measure against other commodities, other currencies, other asset classes. But when you look at the rest of the commodity complex, they've been in a very bullish posture. When you look at the metals, for example, look at gold or silver, platinum, copper, you name it, they've all been in uptrends. What do you think the takeaway is here between how oil hasn't moved like the rest of the commodity complex?
So the industrial metals certainly taking part in this commodity bull market, but oil and even ag sort of being left out, oil having its own dynamics and ag too. But I think they're both going to join the party. You know, I laid out the factors that I'm looking at with oil. On the ag side, it's more difficult in terms of trying to figure out a catalyst, but the prices are still relatively depressed there in terms of generating enough income for farmers to cover a lot of their expenses. And so I think combine this with weakness in the dollar, the desire for hard assets, the appreciation for critical raw materials, that I think it's from a portfolio management standpoint, it's highly interesting to be looking at some of the beaten down areas of commodities.
So Peter, you work at very much a generalist firm, but we do talk a lot about commodities to you. Have you noticed, or who have you noticed, wake up to the commodities trade and, I guess, take part in these bull markets that we're seeing?
Well, it's clearly the institutional and retail side that woke up to the gold and silver rally. Took them a bunch of years to finally realize that there was a fundamental story there. Copper seemingly going up every day. The day we taped this, nickel we talked about is up almost 10%. So I think it's sort of a bull market that's only superficially, or I should say surface level, being acknowledged in gold and silver. I don't think people realize what's happening in the entire industrial metal space and what this means for the whole inflation discussion, what it means for central bank rate cuts outside of the BOJ, what it means for interest rates generally. I think this is noteworthy. And it also gets into the whole geopolitical sphere. Did the U.S. really take Maduro because of drug trafficking and he had machine guns? Well, as president of a country, you control your military. So we arrested him for having machine guns. It was kind of interesting. Maybe it was is deeper than that. Maybe it was because it was our way of wanting access to Venezuela's critical minerals and rare earths, and maybe a way to sort of stiff arm Iran, China, and Russia from their growing presence in the country. So I think it's important that even a generalist investor should be paying attention to what's going on in the commodity space, and oil and ag could play some interesting catch up.
Well, Peter, you brought up the buzzwords there, critical minerals, which has now become a basket of over 60 different minerals on the elemental table. Pretty soon it'll be the whole elemental table that's on the list. But you see a lot of initiatives, not just in the U.S., but in Europe, in Asia, but you see it in Canada, you see it in Australia, to cloister out some of these important critical minerals, whether that's copper or lithium or uranium or rare earths or tungsten or antimony. It seemed like 2025 was a buzz with executive orders and all these policies. What do you think is the key trends that will be surfacing out of critical minerals in 2026?
I think it's going to continue to be access to them. Because when you declare something as a critical mineral, it changes the demand dynamic in the sense that you're not just buying a particular metal, you being an industrial user, for example, just to be an input into a product. You're realizing, oh boy, this is a really important thing that I need to get my hands on, not just in a just-in-time inventory perspective, but maybe I need to stock my shelves for extra inventory because now I'm competing against other people that are doing the same. And just the word critical implies that it's rare. Now, not all metals are rare. Lithium is not rare, for example. But I think now there's, in a way, hoarding involved when you declare something quote-unquote critical. As silver was most recently declared critical according to the U.S. Geological Survey. So I think that just, as I said, adds a different dynamic in terms of the demand side.
So does any of this momentum for commodities slow down at all in 2026, considering just how well some of these did in 2025?
We've all been humbled enough investing in the commodity space. So to declare what things will happen over the full year, I'm not going to be bold enough to say. I do think right now that the supply-demand imbalances are real, and that should continue, but obviously closely monitoring it. We know silver, getting to that, there's supply-demand deficits. It's in the numbers. Platinum, supply-demand deficits, it's in the numbers. So until that's alleviated, then there should be an upward bias.
Peter, another theme from last year that was different than we've seen in a while was how involved the U.S. government was investing in not just commodities and critical mineral companies directly, but also in the tech sector and in AI and chips and, across the board. Do you think we'll continue to see that theme evolve in 2026 where the government's actually playing matchmaker, picking winners, and actually positioning in companies directly?
I hope not. I don't think they're historically very good at it. I understand why they're doing it. I understand the critical nature of what they're doing, but I still think that's best left to the private sector. But they've done it already, and I'm sure they'll do it again.
So what about other themes for 2026? A lot that we keep hearing is AI. Is the AI trade finally going to fizzle out? A lot of attention being on the new Fed chairman that will be coming in, that will be Trump's appointee, which everyone expects more rate cuts there. What other themes are going to be present in 2026 that you have your eyes on?
Well, I'll start with the AI theme. I think it's very important that when people look at this Gen AI data center build out, at this point, the end of 2025, I think an important thing happened in the trade is that people woke up to the fact that not everyone can win. And, the interesting thing about when a new technology comes along, it's very exciting and everyone wants to buy anything that touches the new technology, irrespective of fundamentals, irrespective of stories. If it has the theme, buy it. But that trade always reaches a point where people realize, as I said, not everyone can win. And then they start to differentiate between the winners and losers. And if you look to the latter part of last year, that started to happen. People realize, Oracle, maybe they win, but their balance sheet's getting really stretched here. Even NVIDIA, when they reported their last quarterly earnings, the stock spiked in aftermarket and then the next day traded straight down. Broadcom traded down. You had Meta's stock got punished. They had a phenomenal earnings report, but people focused more on their CapEx spend. Look what's happened to CoreWeave stock. So I think this year, we're going to get more data centers built. We're going to get more demand for product, but it's important as investors to look at the rate of change. Because I think the rate of change, both in the spend, and I think that the stock market performance in terms of the rates of return, I think it's going to slow down this year. And yes, you're going to get days like the early days of 2026, where people are just buying last year's winners and they're spiking stocks up 5, 10, 15% and memory and DRAM and this and that. I just think that the rate of change is now beginning to slow. I think the trade is becoming more, as I said, differentiated. And that is a big deal for both the economic impact and the stock market impact, because we're still so heavily concentrated in it. The other thing that I'm very much focused on, you mentioned, you know, interest rates and the Fed and who's going to be next. The interesting thing that we're seeing that seemingly being ignored is this persistent higher level of long-term interest rates. You know, the Fed started cutting rates in September 2024. They cut 175 basis points. And from the summer of 2024, so right before we started to price in those fall rate cuts, the 10-year yield hasn't fallen. The ECB has cut its deposit rate by 200 basis points, and German and French bond yields, or German bonds and French oat yields, are higher than where they were when they started cutting interest rates. UK gilt yields on the long end, higher in the face of lower short-term interest rates. We have multi-decade highs in JGB yields as they are raising interest rates. So I don't know why people are ignoring, but I have my eye on long-term interest rates, irrespective of what the Fed does in the short end and what other central bankers do, because I think that is a big deal that's sort of being ignored at the moment. So those are the few things that I'm paying attention to here.
Well, Peter, just circling back to the impact of AI, another thing, when I follow your writings on Substack, and you do a great job, I encourage people to follow Peter at Substack, but you often weigh in on companies spend on AI. So the other side of the equation, not the companies that are the picks and shovels, the chip makers, things like that, but the companies deploying artificial intelligence, the spends they've had on it, and whether it's worth the candle or not. Do you think shareholders hold companies more accountable for their AI spend and whether it made sense, and also what impact it may have in the changes in their staff and workforce?
Well, I'll go back to Oracle, for example. Oracle's last quarter, they further raised CapEx. Their CapEx number now is 75% of their revenue, not of their cash flow, not of their free cash flow, their revenue. And Oracle stock has gone from a high of $345 the day of their September quarterly report, when they talked about these remaining performance obligations that exploded in size, mostly due to OpenAI. But that stock has gotten punished ever since, and it's trading basically at the lowest level since last June. And I mentioned Meta that sold off in response to worries about their excessive CapEx. So it's clear that companies are now getting punished for excessive CapEx, whereas the receiver of that spend are still getting rewarded to an extent, less so NVIDIA and Broadcom, more so now the memory guys. They're getting rewarded because that supply-demand situation is still very tight. But you know that will not end well, because we know when you're making a commodity product, you're bound to, after tight supply, you're eventually going to get to loose supply and prices will collapse. But at least right now, those stocks are enjoying the party. But that's to my point of the market becoming much more choosier on picking winners and losers. We're there. And that's the big change from where we were prior to that Oracle fall in September of last year, and certainly compared to 2024, when you know anything AI related ripped to the upside.
Yeah, it does seem like a bit of a shift in tone, but the other big change from last year in this AI spend is a lot more debt was taken on. A lot of the big tech companies were funding everything, no problem, but all these new invites and all these new people getting involved in it seem to be issuing a lot more debt. So maybe that will come to be a problem this year. But as of right now, Peter, we can wrap it up here. Thank you for your outlook for 2026. We're going to be chatting with you throughout the year. And as Shad said, please, everyone, click that link in the show notes to visit Peter's Substack. That is The Book Report. Peter, thank you very much for your time. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.